We continue to move forward in the four aids. Last week we began the section on the guru, on the teacher. We continue. We won't finish it this time, though. We're not in a hurry, so we'll move along at a leisurely pace, and probably next week we'll finish this chapter, the four aids. The first chapter in the Yoga of Divine Works, and the only section of the synthesis of yoga that Sri Aurobindo thoroughly revised. So this reflects largely his view about the practice of yoga as we apply it to our actual lives. We come to the teacher, and he says first in this section, the surest way towards this integral fulfillment is to find the master of the secret who dwells within us. Open ourselves constantly to the divine power, which is also the divine wisdom and love, and trust to it to effect the conversion. Well, a number of things to say about this simple sentence. An integral fulfillment for Sri Aurobindo is not simply the signature of release from ignorance. It is not simply finding out what the essence of your being is, but to return with the effulgence of that liberated light and power within oneself and massage it into the tissues of the body to uplift the feelings, to illuminate the mind, to transform everything into something that reflects the divine presence, vibrates with it. And this is something that is already existent within us. Where do we look for this master? The Gita has told us that it is within, not simply us, but within all beings, turning all beings as if they're mounted upon a machine. At the core of your heart, at the core of your own soul, stands that single divine who is multiple in one, all at once. It is all at once. He says that we should open ourselves to the divine power. So that means that he envisions this divine power as being something above. We open ourselves to it like a flower to the sun. And the power is consonant with what we would call chit shakti. The wisdom is born from the truth of being, which is Sat. And love is a wave or an emanation or a sampling of the sea of Ananda, which this reality is. So it is Sat Chit Ananda, again, that Sri Aurobindo evokes in this opening sentence. This is also something core to his own personal experience. He did not need an external teacher to guide him in his path. He notes in a letter that Lele was not his guru, but an important figure who shared a method with him early in his sadhana. I'm roughly paraphrasing what he said. In another letter, he calls him his guru, but always he means it in a limited sense. He did not regard Lele as somebody who practically put the divine consciousness into him. He taught him a method which led to the foundation of his own sadhana, and that sadhana built over time. And it built because of a deep inner personal relationship that he developed with the divine. So that one who is secret within us was the one whispering in his ear and guiding him step by step in the major phases of his yoga. Now, after his 1908 realization, in which Brahmic Nirvana settled into him, and in a sense, the ego was expunged, it was when he was in the Alipur jail that Krishna came to him and said, roughly again, I tried to tell you I had other work for you. Don't worry, I'll save India. I have others to do that for me, but I have for you a different work, and I want you to be my intermediary in the world for that. I want you to be the vessel through which I work some of these secrets out for the betterment of humanity, and this will be the furtherance of the Sanatana Dharma. And I had to put you in jail because I couldn't seem to get your attention. So I arranged external circumstances to my own favor, and now I have you. So listen. And Sri Aurobindo listened and was led to the discovery of not simply an impersonal reality in which the world was vacant, but a reality which was a person and which infused its personality in the entire world. That divine being was in every multiplied image of itself. Wherever he threw his gaze, he saw only that divinity. Only that. So he lived in that consciousness, and beyond the discovery of this omnipresent personal Godhead, he was led to see that the vision that he had established at the level of the mind was not the only way to become cognizant of the divine, that he could feel it in his body, that he could feel it in his emotions, and that he could see it in ranges of consciousness above the mind, to which he began to climb. And there were important figures which offered leadership to guide him step by step, but principally it was this secret teacher hidden within his own being which led him. He didn't need the uttered word of a guru. He did not need a human guide to accomplish this. Then he stands out rather in a stark contrast with almost all others in being so led from within to that great achievement. So we see in him, at the beginning of his yoga, the consolidation of the impersonal and the personal, of that which is transcendent to the cosmos, that which is deeply figured in all the cosmos, a transcendent and immanent reality which is one. So, trust to it to effect the conversion. But it is difficult for the egoistic consciousness to do this at all at the beginning. And if done at all, it is still difficult to do it perfectly and in every strand of our nature. It is difficult at first because our egoistic habits of thought, of sensation, of feeling, block up the avenues by which we can arrive at the perception that is needed. We have this egoistic bent. Things must come to us in the way that we're accustomed to, that we're familiar with. That is me, this small definition of being, and that stands against the entirety of the universe. So we can't be open as long as we're egoistic. It is difficult afterwards because the faith, the surrender, the courage requisite in this path are not easy to the ego-clouded soul. So there is a soul which is really that thing in us that aspires to go beyond, And the ego clouds it. But these three things are principally important. Faith, Shraddha in Sanskrit, which, as Sri Aurobindo says elsewhere, is something soul-born. This is not something, this is not a mental conviction. The faith that one has arises as a deep wave of knowledge from identity. It knows because it feels. It doesn't know a thing outside of itself. It feels resonant that this is true. It feels that that is a cognate reality to what I am and what I aspire to be. And so, faith, surrender, atma samarpana, the willingness to give up oneself to the large. When we're small, we feel defensive. We have to protect ourselves against the larger universe, which is what the ego offers us. A fence, a fortress against this thing which will overwhelm. But the soul, the strength of the soul, does not need that fence. When it reaches a status of evolution where it can step beyond that and live in concert with the world, and not against the world. So, atma samarpana. And finally, the courage. Courage, sahasa in Sanskrit. To step outside of the ego, one has to have a great heart. One has to have a great vision. One has to be living from the soul. To push it to the side and say, you stand over there in fear, then. I'm going forward. The divine working is not the working which the egoistic mind desires or approves, for it uses error in order to arrive at truth, suffering in order to arrive at bliss, imperfection or in order to arrive at perfection. The ego cannot see where it is being led. It revolts against the leading, loses confidence, loses courage. These failings would not matter. For the divine guide within is not offended by our revolt, not discouraged by our want of faith or repelled by our weakness. He has the entire love of the mother and the entire patience of the teacher. But by withdrawing our assent from the guidance, we lose the consciousness, though not all the actuality, not in any case the eventuality of its benefit. And we withdraw our assent because we fail to distinguish our higher self from the lower, through which he is preparing his self-revelation. The finite in search of the infinite cannot know it when it finds it, because it sees through a small aperture. It can't see the entirety of what the infinite is. It can't find the infinite in the small, because its vision is too restricted. When the vision is open, then you see that in the significant form, there is all of this, and it simply represents it. So, as the Chinese sage can see a limb and have it speak about the whole nature of the cosmos, so our soul, in viewing any element of nature, any aspect of ourself, any aspect of another, the formation of a moving society, discern the truth, what is behind it. As in the world, so in ourselves. When we cannot see God because of his workings and especially because he works in us through our nature and not by a succession of arbitrary miracles. Man demands miracles that he may have faith. He wishes to be dazzled in order that he may see. And this impatience, this ignorance, may turn into a great danger and disaster if, in our revolt against the divine leading, we call in another distorting force more satisfying to our impulses and desires and ask it to guide us and give it the divine name. And as we go on this adventure of consciousness, we will encounter forces larger than this so-called human who will, in seeming collaboration with us, be willing to bestow powers and illuminations upon us which will actually entrap us. And so always to have the guidance, the surety, the tact of the soul present at the front, so that there is no ambition, there is no quest for satisfaction or vain fulfillment, that we really want the pure, the true. That will save us from error and from any imposter that presents itself as the divine along the way. So Sri Aurobindo is saying here that a progressive change is acceptable to the divine. It is not instant. We can't become perfect in an instant, but we will become eventually fulfilled. What is not acceptable is to stop and to accept a failure to progress. So we can't say, because the job is big and because I'm beginning as a small seeming ego, that the work can't be achieved. That's not our business to make that decision. Once we've been called to the spiritual path, simply we do the work. We make the offering of our work, and the results don't belong to us anyway. They never have. All belongs to the divine. And we progress or we stultify according to the divine will. But we can have the deep satisfaction of having made the good effort and given the good offering. That's enough for us. The change, we leave to that. But while it is difficult for man to believe in something unseen within himself, it is easy for him to believe in something which he can image as extraneous to himself. The spiritual progress of most human beings demands an extraneous support, an object of faith outside us. It needs an external image of God, or it needs a human representative, incarnation, prophet, or guru, or it demands both and receives them. For according to the need of the human soul, the divine manifests himself as deity, as human divine, or in simple humanity, using that thick disguise which so successfully conceals the Godhead for a means of transmission of his guidance. So the idea that God is guru, we see for the first time in India, in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, in the 6th chapter, in the 23rd verse, where devotion or bhakti for the divine is the same thing as devotion to one's guru as God. the equation of one and the other, first time in that Upanishad. This notation that Sri Aurobindo makes here about that thick disguise, the mother made a similar notation herself. Champaklal found it and kept it in his record. Her notes were assembled and kept carefully by him. She said something like, "People want to worship. Let them worship you," nodding towards Sri Aurobindo at the samadhi where he was lying. "For me, let me do my work unseen in this body. And of all disguises, the body is the best." Our friend M.P. Pandit, I think, was standing to the side once, waiting to see the mother, and could hear her saying to someone who apparently was wrestling with the idea that here you are, the Divine Mother, in a human body, and I look at you, but all I see is your human body. I don't see anything else. And she was saying, "But don't you understand? This is not me. What I am is all behind. All behind." How do you develop that vision? If all you can see is the skin, is the epidermis, how do you know the substance that is behind? How do you get introduced to the subtler world, to the hierarchical nature of the universe, if you're limited to this physical being? Something has to crack through the physical crust so that you can open to those inner realities. Yoga is not possible if you're confined to this view, which is flat, a flat world view of what is the world. That is not the universe. That is not you. So he describes here the incarnation, the prophet, or the guru. So the teacher, the acharya, the guru, the deshika, is that person in spiritual life who transfers power, awakening, liberating power, into the disciple through the teaching, through the rites, the rituals, through the mantras, but through a means by which an intimate experience is delivered. And that experience is what opens the consciousness. It is the blow that shatters the physical crust. So sometimes it is necessary to have the physical representation of the teacher before you to reach through and touch. And there were many who met the mother and did not have the experience that this other person had, seeing only the physical shell. But as soon as they stepped into her presence, saw only the spiritual enormity that she was, this colossal mother goddess in whom all the universe was located. That was vivid and tangible to their eyes, to their very feeling. And they could never simply see the physical form. That was primary. But that reveals the power and the development of their own evolving soul until they could see all of reality. Be aware. The Hindu discipline of spirituality provides for this need of the soul by the conceptions of the Ishta Devata, the Avatar, and the Guru. By the Ishta Devata, the chosen deity, is meant not some inferior power, but a name and form of the transcendent and universal Godhead. Almost all religions either have as their base or make use of some such name and form of the divine. Its necessity for the human soul is evident. God is the all and more than the all. But that which is more than the all, how shall man conceive? And even the all is at first too hard for him. For he himself, in his act of consciousness, is a limited and selective formation, and can open himself only to that which is in harmony with his limited nature. There are things in the all which are too hard for his comprehension, or seem too terrible to his sensitive emotions and cowering sensations. Or simply, he cannot conceive as the divine, cannot approach or cannot recognize something that is too much out of the circle of his ignorant or partial conceptions. It is necessary for him to conceive God in his own image or in some form that is beyond himself, but consonant with his highest tendencies and seizable by his feelings or his intelligence. Otherwise, it would be difficult for him to come into contact and communion with the divine. So, a name and form of the transcendent and universal Godhead. So, one has a particular affinity with a form, and in entering into identity with that form, discovers the all behind, and the transcendent which is behind the all. It does not then remain exclusive that only this is true, my God is true, and the other is not. It becomes all-inclusive. And this is true for other teachers as well. Sri Ramakrishna was famously capable of finding the identity between the absolute Brahman and the reality of Kali, the mother goddess. He said, they are not different. It's the same reality. What it establishes is a psychological and inner relationship with a personality that represents the whole. The Ishta Devata is a true representative of the one who leads the soul to union, to yoga. He goes on, though, here. Even then, his nature calls for a human intermediary so that he may feel the divine in something entirely close to his own humanity and sensible in a human influence and example. This call is satisfied by the divine manifest in a human appearance, the incarnation, the avatar, Krishna, Christ, Buddha. Or if this is too hard for him to conceive, the divine represents himself through a less marvelous intermediary, prophet or teacher. For many who cannot conceive or are unwilling to accept the divine man are ready to open themselves to the supreme man, terming him not incarnation, but world teacher or divine representative. So the incarnation is the actual divine in a body. the prophet is one who is in profound communication with the divine and represents a world teaching such as might a Muhammad to a waiting and thirsty world, would then be the Jagat Guru. Now, Sri Aurobindo is using the world teacher here in a different sense than he did at the beginning of the chapter. He continues, this also is not enough. A living influence, a living example, a present instruction is needed. For it is only the few who can make the past teacher and his teaching, the past incarnation and his example and influence, a living force in their lives. For this need also, the Hindu discipline provides in the relation of the guru and the disciple, the shishya. The guru may sometimes be the incarnation or world teacher, but it is sufficient that he should represent to the disciple the divine wisdom, convey to him something of the divine ideal, or make him feel the realized relation of the human soul with the eternal. And however faulty the guru may be, whatever human elements may exist, as long as there is that real relationship, that power of communion of the divine that is expressed and sensible, tangible in the teacher, then that being represents a truth, conveys a power. But also it is so that a sincere sadhak, an aspirant, can drive the faulty guru forward. Because the truth and the sincerity of that seeker inspires the guru to greaten himself or herself. So there is mutuality in that relationship, as all relationships are mutual. The sadhaka of the integral yoga will make use of all these aids according to his nature, but it is necessary that he should shun their limitations and cast from himself that exclusive tendency of egoistic mind which cries, my God, my incarnation, my prophet, my guru, and opposes it to all other realization in a sectarian or a fanatical spirit. All sectarianism, all fanaticism must be shunned, for it is inconsistent with the integrity of the divine realization. A year or so into writing in the Arya, Sri Aurobindo sent a note to his readers saying, I'm using the language of India. I'm using Sanskrit and the terms that we're familiar with here, not in the sense of exclusivity, but because they are pregnant with meaning. The Sanskrit is multi-significant, capable of expressing things that it's difficult to say in English or a conventional language. Of course, Sanskrit can become conventional too, but when Sri Aurobindo is working with the Veda and with the Upanishads, the language there is pellucid. It's powerful. It's wonderful. But he wanted to say that I am not simply teaching from India's tradition. What I'm saying resonates with the world. This is a world that demands an integration of East and West. And this is a way towards that. This is a way towards the integrality that we all seek. Integrality means that diversity is not excluded, but made part of a living oneness. So why should any aspect, why should any teaching, why should the essence of any truth be excluded It should be joyfully embraced and brought in. On the contrary, the sadhaka of the integral yoga will not be satisfied until he has included all other names and forms of deity in his own conception, seeing his own ishta devata in all others, unified all avatars in the unity of him who descends in the avatar, welded the truth in all teachings into the harmony of the eternal wisdom. Nor should he forget the aim of these external aids, which is to awaken his soul to the divine within him. Nothing has been finally accomplished if that has not been accomplished. It is not sufficient to worship Krishna, Christ, or Buddha without, if there is not the revealing and the formation of the Buddha, the Christ, or Krishna in ourselves. And all other aids equally have no other purpose. Each is a bridge between man's unconverted state and the revelation of the divine within him. So you can see that he's leading us from and out of our ego into experience, into identification with the divine, and into a concretization of the divine in our lives. So this is a great place to end for this evening. We'll finish the chapter next week. We have faith that we'll do that. This is a continuation of the section in Savitri that we were reading last time. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, in Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. A greater personality sometimes possesses us, which yet we know is ours. Or we adore the master of our souls. Then the small bodily ego thins and falls. No more insisting on its separate self, losing the punctilio of its separate birth, it leaves us one with nature and with God. In moments when the inner lamps are lit, and the life's cherished guests are left outside, our spirit sits alone and speaks to its gulfs. A wider consciousness opens then its doors, invading from spiritual silences. A ray of the timeless glory stoops a while to commune with our seized illumined clay, and leaves its huge white stamp upon our lives. In the oblivious field of mortal mind, revealed to the closed prophet eyes of trance, or in some deep internal solitude, witnessed by a strange immaterial sense, the signals of eternity appear. The truth mind could not know unveils its face. We hear what mortal ears have never heard. We feel what earthly sense has never felt. We love what common hearts repel and dread. Our minds hush to a bright omniscient. A voice calls from the chambers of the soul. We meet the ecstasy of the Godhead's touch in golden privacies of immortal fire. These signs are native to a larger self that lives within us by ourselves unseen. Only sometimes a holier influence comes. A tide of mightier surgings bears our lives, and a diviner presence moves the soul. Or through the earthly coverings something breaks, a grace and beauty of spiritual light, the murmuring tongue of a celestial fire. Our self and a high stranger whom we feel, it is and acts unseen as if it were not. It follows the line of sempiternal birth, yet seems to perish with its mortal frame. Assured of the apocalypse to be, it reckons not the moments and the hours. Great, patient, calm, it sees the centuries pass, awaiting the slow miracle of our change in the sure, deliberate process of world force and the long march of all revealing time. It is the origin and the master clue, a silence overhead, an inner voice, a living image seated in the heart, an unwalled wideness and a fathomless point, the truth of all these cryptic shows in space, the real towards which our strivings move, the secret grandiose meaning of our lives. A treasure of honey in the combs of God, a splendor burning in a tenebrous cloak, it is our glory of the flame of God, our golden fountain of the world's delight, an immortality cowled in the cape of death, the shape of our unborn divinity. It guards for us our fate in depths within, where sleeps the eternal seed of transient things. Always we bear in us a magic key concealed in life's hermetic envelope, a burning witness and the sanctuary regards through time and the blind walls of form. A timeless light is in his hidden eyes. He sees the secret things no words can speak, and knows the goal of the unconscious world and the heart of the mystery of the journeying years. Pages 47 to 49. Namaste. Jai Ma.